The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, February 29th, 2008, and this is episode number 116. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to talk about MotoGP and World Superbike. We've got some good stuff going on with the show today. First of all, happy birthday to all of those of you that are born on the leap year, February 29th. You only get a birthday once every 4 years, but we are doing the leap year thing, so it's February 29th. Kind of cool that we had a show going on. Other stuff that we have, let's see, we've got a great call with Jules Cisek. We're going to wrap up the World Superbike opener at Qatar that happened this past weekend, and it was two very, very good races in the Superbike series. I enjoyed them both a lot and enjoyed talking to Jules about them, and I think you're going to like our conversation. Before we get to that, we have some administrative stuff to take care of and some exciting announcements and things like that, and we're also going to do a very brief little sort of technical segment about suspension that's courtesy of David Emmett over there at the Kropotkin Thinks blog at MotoGP Matters. So, let's see. First administrative little tidbit. Thank you very much. Big giant shout out to Martin Darlington of the UK, who's kind enough to send in a donation to MotoGPOD that helps pay for the Skype bills and the bandwidth and the hosting and the MotoGP.com subscriptions and the magazine subscriptions and all the bills and things that I tend to incur as doing the podcast and just sort of following my kind of passion of MotoGP, which our passion. And I do really appreciate that, Martin. That was super kind stuff. Very nice of you. Martin also sent me a rather long email telling me some stuff here, and I want to announce this. This is a cool thing. He sort of asked me to do it as a favor, and this is something that I definitely would have mentioned with or without a donation. So it's not like Martin is bribing me, although I, do accept bribes. But in any case, Martin says, first of all, Martin was in the British Army, the Royal Army, for 22 years. So congratulations on finishing your career there in the Royal Army, Martin. And then he says, once I left the Army in January 06, I was very fortunate to walk into my dream job, which is flying an air ambulance helicopter. We are based in Wales, which has some of the most stunning on- and off-road motorcycling routes in the UK. There are a large number of bike clubs in Wales itself and many others from the nearer parts of England. They tend to come across the border for rideouts in the spring and summer. Thankfully, we're not called out too often to accidents that are involving bikes. Most people are often surprised to learn that in my two-plus years doing this job, I've been to a lot more horse-riding accidents than motorcycle ones. But when we do get called out to a motorcycle accident, it's good to be able to help fellow bikers. Now, one thing is that all the air ambulances in England and Wales are funded solely by charitable donations. It's kind of an interesting sort of a tidbit in a country that has, national health and all of that, but the air ambulances are funded by, charitable donations. So Martin says, far from just asking you to ask your British listeners to just give money to their local air ambulance charity, which most bike clubs do anyway, and is a good thing if you're there in the UK, you should consider making a charitable donation to your air ambulance. But Martin would actually like to invite you to the Wales Air Ambulance Helimed Rideout for this year, which is going to take place on Saturday, the 12th of July. So you got plenty of time to plan. Saturday, the 12th of July, and I'm sure I'll announce this again in a month or two when we're getting closer to the 12th of July. From Llandudno in Wales to Swansea, which is also in Wales, with a big party and a charity auction at the end. There's special rates available for bikers at the hosting hotel near Swansea, and there's also a raffle with a Suzuki GSXR 750 as the prize, so some really good stuff going on. Details of all of this will be posted very shortly on the Rideout website, which can be found at www.helimedrideout.co.uk, and we'd really appreciate it if you could sing this out to your listeners. And of course, I will post that website address on the MotoGPOD.com website, but it was helimedrideout.co.uk. On last year's ride, which Martin says we foolishly allowed to clash with the Isle of Man TT's 100th centenary weekend, but however, they still got 200 bikes and they participating, and they raised over £10,000 for the air ambulance. So I think that's a good thing. Thanks to you for your service there, Martin, and both in the Army and as a Helimed pilot. And I think it's a good thing that you're able to basically contribute and continue, you know, being a very, very helpful member of society, I guess would be the word I'm looking for, but that's good stuff. And Martin is about to do his first track day. So I think that's awesome. And got some information out of our track day segments that we were doing in our off season. And I'm glad to hear that, Martin, and good luck on your track day, but be aware that track day bug is a very, very contagious one. And the next thing you know, you'll be spending a lot of time and money and all of that sort of stuff to go and do track days. But there's a lot worse ways to spend your time, that's for sure. All right, another bit of cool administrativa that we have to take care of, and this is very, very exciting news, and I'm sure you have been waiting for it. We got to announce the winner of our contest. If you'll recall, 2 weeks ago, we had David Podolsky from Chicken Hawk Racing on here, and he talked a lot about tires and tire warmers, which is what Chicken Hawk Racing manufactures, tire warmers, but he talked about how those tire warmers affect your tires and what's going on, the best strategies for using tire warmers and why they're a good idea, and a lot of good information on there. And David was really gracious, fantastic phone call. I really enjoyed it a lot. And then at the end of that, when we did a contest, and the prize for that contest is a set of Ben Spies's actual tire warmers used by Ben Spies. You know, they say Suzuki all over them, this sort of stuff. So, you know, this is a cool thing, both as a functional prize that, you know, a set of tire warmers that you can use, and as a sort of a souvenir because it's something that was used by Ben Spies. So, people emailed in there, or actually, excuse me, they signed up on the chickenhawkracing.com website. David said he got a large response. He was very happy with that, and he randomly picked a winner, and it is Dennis Jones out of Bethel Park, Pennsylvania. So congratulations, Dennis. You are the winner of a set of Ben Spies's tire warmers, which is really, really good. And also, David is going to throw in a set of CHR mechanic gloves as well. So you get some Chicken Hawk Racing mechanics gloves and Ben Spies's tire warmers from the Laguna Seca round, where he won the AMA Superbike title. So they're even, you know, sort of doubly extra special. These are the tire warmers that warmed his tires that carried him to victory over the dark forces and all that good stuff, if you want to look at it that way. So again, big congratulations there to Dennis, and a big giant thank you to David Podolsky of Chicken Hawk Racing for supplying that prize. And all right, that concludes our administrative remarks that we had going on, a fairly brief section of that sort of thing on this show. Why don't we go ahead and move on to our little suspension chit chat from David Emmett. As promised last week, we have sort of a tech segment here. This is actually an email that I received from David Emmett, a.k.a. Kropotkin, from the Kropotkin Thinks blog at MotoGPMatters.com. And David is explaining suspension here. So I guess said I'm going to go ahead and use it as a mini sort of tech segment, because he very succinctly, very eruditely explains what is going on with your suspension. And I think this was insightful and good stuff. And he definitely put it into words much better than I could, because as he says in his email, he says, it was a great show, a very interesting interview with David Podolsky from Chicken Hawk Racing. Good stuff. One word of criticism, though. You made what we Brits describe as a dog's dinner of explaining suspension and how it works, so I thought I'd try to clear it up. He says, a lot of people think that suspension exists to absorb bumps in the road. And put briefly, that's exactly what it does. But to summarize suspension as just a way to absorb bumps is to miss out on why this is a desirable thing. The reason that you want to absorb bumps is not just because it's more comfortable for the rider, but to keep as much traction from your tires as possible and to keep the bike as settled as possible. So a better way to describe the function of suspension is as a means of keeping your tires stuck to the road with exactly the right amount of force to provide optimal grip. To keep your tires on the asphalt, the suspension has two jobs to do. It needs to react to the surface, and it needs to dissipate the energy from that reaction. Reacting to the surface is done by the spring component of your suspension, which allows the front wheel to move and temporarily stores the energy from that movement. Dissipating the energy from that movement is down to the oil and gas in the damping part of your suspension, which allows the stored energy to be released in a controlled way. To put it another way, the spring controls the movement of the front wheel in an up and down sense, and the damping controls the rate of change of the movement of the front wheel. So first, the spring. The spring is usually a wound steel coil with a particular spring rate. Spring rate is just a measure of how much force is required to compress the spring a given distance. So to put it simply, for a given spring rate, a 160-pound rider will compress the suspension on a bike, say for example, 1 inch, whereas a 240-pound rider will compress it 4 inches. If the bike is set up for a 200-pound rider, then this would mean that when the bike hits a bump in the road, the 160-pound rider will be thrown out of the saddle because the combined weight of bike plus rider is not enough to absorb the bump, while the 240-pound rider will be thrown out of the saddle because the suspension is already mostly used up, meaning the spring is already a bit compressed. So the bump makes the suspension bottom out because there's no more spring left to absorb that bump. So in an ideal world, you would swap the springs for one with different spring rates specifically chosen for each rider, but motorcycle manufacturers can't afford to do that with an ordinary street bike. So instead, they have given us preload or spring preload. What preload does is exactly what it says on the tin. It preloads the spring, which means it compresses the spring a given amount. You do this to increase the amount of energy that it takes to compress that spring by a given amount. Increasing the preload is equivalent to adding weight to the bike, a bit like adding luggage. So in our example, for the 240-pound rider, you would increase the preload by the equivalent of 40 pounds to make the bike behave the same as when it was set up for the 200-pound rider. For the 160-pound rider, you reduce the preload, thus reducing the amount of energy that is required for that first inch of suspension travel. The disadvantage of preload is that it changes the amount of suspension travel available, and it can also change the height that the motorcycle sits at. So for a 240-pound rider, adding preload means that the first 3 or 4 inches of suspension travel are already used up, leaving the rider with only another 3 or 4 inches left to play with. If the rider hits a 5-inch bump, the suspension is going to bottom out, and the rider is going to be thrown out of the saddle, and more importantly, the wheel is going to lose contact with the road for a brief second. For the 160-pound rider, reducing preload means that the bike sits physically higher, thus changing the weight distribution, the steering angle, the rake, the trail, and in fact the entire geometry of the bike, making it handle completely differently. If the rear of the bike sits higher, it could make the bike turn in more quickly, but it could be much more twitchy and unstable in a straight line. If the rear of the bike sits lower, it becomes more stable in a straight line, but it would require much more effort to force it into a corner, thus making it more difficult to ride. The best thing to do is to get springs that are fitted to match your weight and riding style. These will mean that the bike sits exactly the right height, which is the static sag, i.e. the amount the suspension compresses under just the weight of the bike, and actually on the rider, David, I'm going to add that, and his gear, while reacting to bumps predictably and smoothly. The other component of suspension is damping, and as a rule, suspension damping is becoming ever more adjustable on modern sports bikes. As I said before, damping dissipates the energy from the suspension movement, and this movement happens in two directions. Compression, which happens as a bump forces the wheel up into the bike, and rebound, which happens as the wheel passes over the bump and the road smooths out again. Compression is the inward movement as the two ends of the forks or shock are forced together, and rebound is the outward movement as the two ends of the shock move apart to resume their normal suspension. You increase compression damping to increase the resistance to bumps. So if your compression damping is too soft and you hit a big bump at speed, the front wheel is forced up into the bike with so much momentum that it leaves the ground. Increasing compression damping absorbs more of the energy more quickly, meaning that the front wheel doesn't move so violently and it can track the road surface more easily. But too much compression damping means that there is too much resistance to movement, and it can leave you being kicked out of the saddle again. Increasing compression damping is generally good for large bumps at high speeds under heavy braking, but not as good for slow speeds, as the suspension is too resistant to movement, and it's no good for ripples at speed, as the suspension cannot respond quickly enough, and it ends up being fully compressed before it has time to spring back into position. Now, you increase rebound damping to slow the returning of the wheel to its original position. When rebound damping is too low, then the spring overwhelms the damping and the shock bounces back beyond its original position. It overextends and then it has to compress again. To visualize what too little rebound damping would look like, imagine a large 1960s car driving over a rutted track. The car will start to wallow and bounce. This unsettles the vehicle and means the tires are once again leaving the road surface and losing grip. Increasing the rebound damping will help the shock to return to its original position after absorbing a bump, but increase it too much and the shock cannot move quickly enough, leaving the shock compressed with less movement to absorb the following bump. So the high-end shocks nowadays also have separate high-speed and low-speed damping channels to deal with some of these problems that are outlined above. At high speed, you want strong enough high-speed damping to cope with braking and big bumps, but less low-speed damping so that you more easily absorb ripples in the asphalt. To summarize all of the above as briefly as possible, you adjust spring preload as a quick way to match your weight to the bike and to control the amount of force needed to compress the suspension. You adjust compression damping to control how much the bike reacts to bumps and to braking, making it respond more smoothly. And you adjust rebound damping to control how the bike responds after a bump, helping to keep the bike as predictable and stable as possible. So, thank you very much, David. I do appreciate the interesting text segment that you wrote there. I think it did explain suspension in a way for sort of mere mortals to understand. We're going to probably try to do a better, longer suspension text segment here soon. I did one quite a long time ago, back in 2005, when I started the show with Max McAllister from Traction Dynamics, and that was pretty interesting, and I learned a lot. So if you want to go back through the archives at MotoGPOD.com, you can find that. Just look up suspension or Max McAllister or something along those lines, and you'll find my two-part interview with Max McAllister. But as a good quick brush up, and like I said, putting it in easy to understand terms, David, that was unmatched, and thank you very much. And if you out there, listeners, if you don't check out Kropotkin Thinks at MotoGPMatters.com, which is David's blog, I encourage you to do so. It's excellent stuff. It's very, very well written. He has a little bit of news, race reports, analysis, all sorts of interesting stuff that he puts up there. He has a lot of time, and he writes very, very well. So it's an interesting read. MotoGPMatters.com. Well, all right. We got Jules on the phone today. And how you doing, Jules?
Good morning. I'm doing fine.
Good, good, cool. Yeah, it is the morning as Jules and I record this. And we have some motorcycle racing to talk about, which is kind of fun, isn't it, Jules? I mean, that's always good. And basically, what happened last weekend was World Superbike in Qatar, and I was I was happy. I thought it was really well. It went pretty good.
It was a very exciting two races, and it was a great way for the. So we should probably announce the fact that this is probably going to contain spoilers, right?
I suppose we should. Yeah, we might as well mention that because, yeah, so if you haven't seen the races, we are going to talk about the results and all of that sort of thing. So I guess you can't listen right now. But it's a good call. I'm sure it's going to be so, one way or the other.
But. So, I think that what everybody was waiting to see was just how the new Ducati would do. And it was a track that Ducati is not particularly strong at. During this 999 era, so I think everybody was very surprised by the results because Ducati did extremely well.
Right.
So that was a big part, and of course, you know, there was just some great racing, and the usual suspects were back, sort of. Most of them were, and some of them were not. And
one thing I wanted to kind of mention is with that Ducati, the sort of supremacy that we saw there, I shouldn't say supremacy, but the competitiveness of the new bike out on its first race, winning there. They'd never won at Qatar before, and as I've now just spoiled it, they obviously did, at least win one of those races, right? Do you think we're going to see World Superbike turning back into the Ducati Cup? Is the 1098 too much? I mean, they're getting a 6-kilo weight penalty.
I think that we could very easily see the Ducati Cup. Remember last year, after the Valencia race, the Magny-Cours race.
Uh-huh.
You and I were talking, and we were talking about how Haga just barely missed his chance to be a world champion, and that it was really his last chance because this year we would have the 1098, and it would rule again, Yeah, I think that's it could turn into that, but there's something interesting that came up with a conversation I had with a friend of mine about. And usually, when I say a friend of mine, I'm particularly talking about Dario. Hi, Dario, who is also used to be on Ride On 2 as Rossi Nanvale Rossi. he's really knowledgeable, and he's Italian, so he gets some great insights from the Italian press that we don't get translated. So anyway, so he and I were talking, and we came up with this theory that the reason why World Superbike has these two early races and then it takes a big break is that they want to start the season before MotoGP so that they get the spotlight for a little while, right? And then once MotoGP gets going, it's like they're not going to get as much press anyway anymore. So they take a break, and I think this is the time they're going to use this year to adjust to see, like, hey, how did that 1098 do? And if it was all-conquering, all-powerful, way better than the other bikes, then we're going to slap another 3 kilos on it, which is something that they did say that they will do if need be before the season started. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, you know, they didn't completely blow the field away, but if you look at the amount of Ducatis that were in the top 10, it was pretty impressive.
Fairly dominating. And also figure this is a brand new bike out on, you know, its first race weekend, so there's going to be developments and things happening, so it's only going to improve, and to a point. I mean, World Superbike, it's not quite like MotoGP where the bike can be completely different the next week, but you know there are improvements that they can make through the season and still stay within the rules.
Yeah.
Not to mention, of course, just the getting a better grip on the settings and the tuning in and all of that sort of thing that they have to do. So I don't know. I was just, like I said, it made me a little concerned. And in fact, Jonathan Green, our frantic announcer there for World Superbike, was just in the middle of mentioning that the Ducati, that they were going to see how the Ducati was going to do, and then they might, and then something happened, and he never exactly said what they might do, and I wasn't 100% sure. I knew it was another weight penalty, but I couldn't remember exactly what it was, so it's going to be a possibility of another 3 kilos, so
yep.
6.5 pounds, yeah. I mean, and it can make a difference, you know, they're as it is now, they have a 6 kilo weight penalty, and that is a significant amount. It is enough to make a difference. But whatever, the races were good. I actually thought the first part of race one was a little, I don't know, the first several laps weren't all that fantastic, other than Neukirchner's unbelievable start. You know, from fourth on the grid there, you know, he's in the front row, but at the, you know, on the outside of the front row, and he launched and got the whole shot and led, I don't know off the top of my head how many laps it was, but it was quite a few, and just looked spectacular.
He did, but you know the problem with, like, I mean, this is he reminded me very much of how Yamaha did in this race also, and mm-hmm. Last year, is like he just ate his tire and it cost him in the end.
Exactly, I think so too.
So this is I think motorcycle racing is not just like going balls out. You have to really plan. And
especially at a track like Qatar.
And especially at a track like Qatar, exactly.
Yeah.
It was hot. They,
hot, hard on tires. Yeah. And, you know, they had a sandstorm, shocker, you know, the day before the race or whatever. So I'm sure the track was just really dirty. I get you're kind of going all over the map here, but I sort of had all these sort of thoughts that keep coming in. That one corner where we kept seeing small minor slips, particularly
Bayless,
yeah, and I think the same corner where Haga fell that we're going to talk about in a minute. Did they ever say anything about that corner? You know, what was going on? Was it just
not during the race? And I didn't really do that much reading on the various RSS feeds that I read about it. I just think that there are probably a lot of surprises. More like rather than like a particular corner, I think there was just like, you know, a couple of grains of sand could make you slip.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
So
and I'm sure there's a few grains of sand in Qatar.
Yeah.
So, and speaking of that Haga crash, that was basically around the point where, to me, race one really started getting interesting. Not because Haga crashed, but it's just sort of a coincidence of a variety of other things. But there was a Biaggi kind of checked up and sort of got right in front of Haga there, sort of a thing, and Haga had to check up a little bit, and he takes his hands off the bars, one hand off the bars.
So the thing that I have not heard noted mentioned, but it looked to me, I looked it over, it looked to me like they actually had their tires touched, or was it just the angle? I mean, there was only one angle you could see it from, and it looked like basically that Biaggi passed. So I think Haga was in fourth at this point.
I think so.
Or third, yeah. Maybe. And Biaggi passed him because it was Roy Kirshner. And then it was in front of him was...
At that point.
Corser. Oh, yeah, sorry, behind him was Corser. And then it was...
Was it Biaggi or Haga then Biaggi?
This is sad. Yeah, it was Haga, yeah. Then Biaggi. Biaggi passes Haga... And has to touch his brakes because Corser slowed down, and so he touched his brakes, and I think it looked like they did touch, and then afterwards Haga got really upset.
Right, I couldn't get it. I watched it. You know, I was watching it on TiVo, and I kind of backed it up a couple of times and watched through. And the angle of the camera was at and everything, and I couldn't see exactly. You know, like that kind of a thing. I couldn't tell exactly what was going on, but yeah, Haga got upset and takes one hand off the bar as a sort of a, and made either maybe a gesture or you know, something.
Oh, he's definitely waving.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
He's definitely, you know, like shaking his fist.
Kind of a Whiskey Tango Foxtrot sort of a, you know, move. And then flies off the motorcycle. But did you see how fast he got up and got that motorcycle back on track? That had to be one of the quickest recoveries I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean he was back. Well, I think he went because it was still fairly early in the race, so there were still a train.
Yeah,
he did lose a lot of positions, but he didn't lose a lot of time.
Right.
So I think that the moment he took his, first of all, he's waving. You know, he's gesticulating at a guy who's not going to see him.
Exactly.
because he just passed him. And it was such a bonehead maneuver. I cannot believe that he did something stupid like that. I think the moment he took his hand off the handlebar and, you know, basically high-sided because the bike got destabilized,
mm-hmm.
He
knew?
As he was flying through the air, I'm sure he was like, I'm an idiot. And so, so when he landed, he was already like... Getting ready to, it wasn't like he was surprised. It wasn't like one of those high sides where you're going through a corner and then, whoa, I'm flying. It was more like I effed up and he was already preparing to get up as soon as he hit the ground. You know?
Yeah, that's actually
because he really did
jump
up fast. It was amazing.
Oh, and the picking up the bike. You know, normally you see these guys. These aren't always very very big guys. You know,
fairly
heavy motorcycle, and especially, you know, you see him struggling sometimes with especially the smaller guys. But no, he just lifted that thing up. There's nothing.
Yeah.
And,
with its extra 6 kilos.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. He doesn't get the six kilos.
I'm sorry.
It's why it was. He was saving those 6 kilos.
Right.
Had there been that 6 kilos on the bike, he would have been struggling. So there's Haga's. Oh, and also, again, Jonathan Green was just blistering in his scathing remarks about Haga. You could see he was clearly disgusted that Haga would do such a bonehead move. And, I mean, he said something along the lines of where it's just like, you know, I'm writing off talking about Haga for the rest of the race. He's in the corner.
Right.
I thought it was kind of funny.
Which is pretty appropriate because you pretty much could write Haga off for the rest of the race. He was 13th.
That's true.
Or 14th.
And that first one, 14th. So, and he was all the way down to, you know, like 24th or
25th.
And so he, you know, he did all right considering, but still must have been a shocker. Noy Kirshner did pick the lead back up again. Have you seen the new World Superbike website, by the way?
Much better than last year.
And they have the reports are a little bit different this year too, so they're actually really good.
They've got these great videos that if you live in North America, you can click on and get ready to watch, and then the music starts and it says, "Oh, I'm sorry, we can't show you this in your region."
Oh, nice. Blacked out. Yeah.
But it's like they give you all the possible, like, you know, teasers, and you're all excited about it. Like, oh, I'm going to get to see, like, highlights at least.
and then they screwed
you. They didn't even show you highlights. I mean, it's pathetic. Anyway.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't looked at it that much. I'm going to have to check out their website a little more now that I see. I've been... So, I don't know. MotoGP.com is just aggravating me lately. It's kind of coloring my whole web experience. It's like, man, all these websites are getting virtually unusable. Crash.net is busier than ever. Okay, carrying on. I was still real impressed by Noy Kirshner's performance overall. And I'll admit, it was a little bit like he was trying to break away, and I think he shagged his tires. But, you know, he was still in the hunt right up through the first whole half of the race. And considering that last year, you know, he was a strong rider, but, you know, I'm not sure how he finished or anything in the season. But, he, you know, he was never that much of a contender or anything like that. And then there was the comment that, you know, he basically didn't even get any testing time this year because he's sort of the third rider and and all that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Behind, you know, Nieto and Kageyama, who, incidentally, he finished better than in that race one. But so I was real impressed with his performance. And then, of course, Max Biaggi is the other guy who I was like jumping up and down for those last, five, six laps there. And I thought we were going to see Biaggi win it and hoping. And then it's like that last lap kind of pass going on, classic Bayless move he managed to get up past on Biaggi. And,
you know, Bayless, I think, showed probably the most unbelievable ride there because he really looked like there was just no way he was going to finish it on the podium the way he was. He made a lot of mistakes. And you know, even afterwards, he didn't say anything about, like, oh, my! I had a problem with my front tire or the track or anything like that. It was basically like, I slipped a couple times here and there. Uh-huh. But from the outside, it looked like, you know, he almost lost the bike. He went off the track a couple times. He went into he literally went into the dirt a couple times. And
several times, right.
He still managed to, you know, keep it up there. And that was amazing. And, he's just a fantastic rider. And Biaggi's a fantastic rider, too. But so one thing that I noticed about Biaggi, and it was getting really frustrating because I really wanted to see him win this race.
Uh-huh.
He lost this race. He didn't have it taken away from him. He's the one who's responsible for losing this race because he just could not figure out that second to last corner. He was always going wide in that corner. He would pass somebody, then go wide there.
And
even when he wasn't, there was somebody next to him, he was going wide. So it wasn't like that's what lost him the race. I mean, that's where Bayless got a good drive out for the last corner and then won the race. Was in that previous corner, Max went wide again and he had to slow down a little bit more than Troy, and so he didn't get as good of a drive out.
Yeah.
This is Biaggi's, I think, weakness, and it goes back to throughout his entire MotoGP career. People took advantage of this, like, knowing how he rides. I think that he's not the best breaker. You know, there's some people that you can say, like Marco Melandri, Barros, Rossi, those guys who are just like unbelievable in the breaks. You know, Tony Elias, they can break really deep and still make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But Biaggi is still that, you know, he was the ultimate 250 rider. And
he never went beyond that.
I think he still rides a little bit like that. Even after all these years on big bikes, I think he still rides it like a small bike and one where you can serve energy.
Right, and carry your corner speed. So it makes me wonder how you would do on the 800s.
It does, actually. I didn't even think about that, but that's a good point.
Yeah, which we'll never see, unfortunately. And I kind of miss Biaggi. I mean, he was always the bad boy of MotoGP. But I like to see him at least, you know, doing well, especially on a privateer team. I mean,
that was great. Yeah,
it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, they are a privateer team, but I think one of the benefits it's just like the Dantin team on MotoGP last year, the first year of the new class of bikes. You're probably going to have the closest to the factory for that particular model of motorcycle, right?
Right.
I mean, they are different. They even have different designations, but I think that they're basically very as similar as they're going to get. They're going to get less similar next year, you know?
Right. So this might be Sterrell Garda's chance that, you know, the team, the privateer team, this is going to be their chance to outshine the factory, you think, this year and next year? That's going to be slipped through their fingers,
Well, not to the fingers, but it's going to be harder.
Right.
I know.
But it was, yeah, definitely a super impressive performance. And, you know, he picked up second spot on the podium, and, you know, it was good to
I think he really wanted that win, though.
Yeah, I think he did, too.
He himself led for, what, seven laps?
Six official on the
six
thing
laps.
Here.
And then he, and not only led, but like was pulling away from the field. Bayless really just is like a Superman. He's like the, he's in a different class. I mean, when he's on, because he sometimes is just not on, or maybe his style just doesn't fit the particular race, tire, track combination. But, you know, just watching him, he was just riding a totally different way and still managing to make it work. I love seeing that kind of stuff. It was great. While I really did want to see Max win, just like you, I think that it would have been a very cool way for Max to start the year off, you know, with last year, first race, first time he's ever been in World Superbikes, first race he wins it, and like whoa, you know.
Right.
And then it would have been cool if he could repeat that. But, you know, he still got podium, second place. And then he also finished well in the second race.
Right.
He finished ahead of Bayless.
Exactly. Second race, yeah. Bayless had a whole different experience in the second race. Which, why don't we go ahead and talk about the second race a little bit, which was... a lot of times you watch World Superbike and the two races are almost... you know, mirror images of, or not mirror images, but the same, you know, one another. And, they, you know, this was definitely not the case with those two races in Qatar. I don't think there was a whole different shakeup. And, one thing I happened to notice too, particularly about race two, is World Superbikes Umbrella Girls are astonishingly hot. And, I mean, even I think more so than MotoGP, but especially when you're in a country like Qatar, where they're, you know, I'm surprised they're not wearing burkas. So, but yeah, talking about race two.
Okay, you know, Bob, let's talk about race two.
Corser and Haga both, that was impressive right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And it looked like, you know, that was going to be, but again, maybe they had to a point the same sort of, you know, that tire thing, you know, they tried to do a breakaway sort of a thing and it didn't quite work out for them with the Yamaha. This is the issues that the Yamaha has on these kind of tracks.
So, you know, this is an interesting thing. Like Yamaha out of all the teams has the least changes in their motorcycles since last year.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to have figured out the whole tire going off thing about halfway through last year, and that's why Haga was able to mount his attack on the championship. I was really actually quite surprised that they were obviously running really well. The bikes were great, and the riders were doing a really good job. They were pulling away from the rest of the... It looked like they were just going to, you know, totally dominate the second race. And then the tires went off. So I'm thinking, like, is it that they figured it out, or is it that the second half just had tracks that didn't put as much pressure on the front tire as the first half of the year? I was kind of looking at the race calendar, and I just can't imagine. It's not like we have like one style of track for the first half and one style of track for another. I really don't know what the connection is, but I was very surprised to see that they had the same problem again. Because this is what killed them last year. It was like the first half of the season, they were just leading and then just falling through the ranks.
A huge fade, exactly. Well, they're using the new Pirellis, right? The Diablo Rosso.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So right. I wonder if that's you know, and I mean realistically, how these tires aren't the same. You know, these are virtually a specially made tires, so, you know, maybe my theory on that one's not going anywhere. But, yeah, this is true. It's just start off real, real good, and then a horrendous fade. But so not too sure exactly why that happened. It'd be interesting to do some reading and see if we can get some honest sort of news of that one. But the other battle on that race too was Chaus and Biaggi.
Oh, that was great. Man,
yes, that was.
These are teammates. You know, yes. So they're on the same equipment, and they're both very good at this track. Chaus has been always had good finishes there, even in MotoGP. That was his one MotoGP podium. And so I'm not surprised to see him up there, but it was wow. When he's on, he's another guy who's like he's a very brave rider. He's a very big rider. You can really tell.
He's huge.
You know, yeah. like what a difference between him and Biaggi is. They're on the same bike. They look very different on yes. those bikes. They definitely ride the corners differently. They have different lines. So it was really fun to watch those two guys.
It was amazing.
Scrap
it was,
it out.
Again, yeah, edge of my seat. And none of this thing, like I mentioned for the first race where, you know, that the first few laps just weren't all that super exciting. No, this one just got, it was a real cracking race right off the bat. And there was, you know, these guys were out for it. And I'm sure the team was just going, you know, eight back in the pits because these guys were racing each other hard. And they're not exactly, you know, the chummiest of guys. So they're not going to give each other much slack out there. And you know, to watch your two motorcycles with your two team, you know, these two teammates, and if they, you know, my God, they're going to take each other out, you know, that's got to be a truly hair-pulling experience back in the pits.
Yeah.
But it made for some good racing. But the star of this race had to be Fonsi Nieto.
Obviously. Well, because he won.
Because he won, yes. But also his on Corser and Haga on the third lap, that pass that he made was, I thought, was like, wow, you know?
Oh,
and,
yeah. That's right. And, he took them both.
Yeah, and this is a guy who never, last year, you know, didn't live up to the expectations at all. I mean, he had, you know, he's a talented 250 rider back, you know, a couple of years ago and all of that, but, you know, had his issues and all of that. And last year, his performance in World Superbike was nothing spectacular, you know? So for him to win the second race is kind of cool, and hopefully he continues that through the season. He's on, you know, he's on the good team. That you know, Alstari Suzuki is going to be one of the strong teams there in World Superbike. So he might be a force to be reckoned with. We got a lot of talent in World Superbike. I was actually looking through. I don't recall that World Superbike has ever had anything like this many guys that used to be in MotoGP, and maybe they're. The whole path to World Superbike is going through some sort of a change. And, you know, so rather than, you know, it's becoming the place where MotoGP guys go to retire, which I've said before, mm-hmm. more than it is of a, you know, younger guys or you know, you choose your path of your World Superbike or MotoGP. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've got, Checa that went to, World Superbikes this year and, mm-hmm. And did well.
Yes.
I mean, this first time out. And then, I mean, Barros was there last year. Obviously, Biaggi. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't say Bayless went there because he was in... I mean, he bounced around between the series.
Right, but he did MotoGP, he did a full season and yep. all of that. And
but he did World Superbikes before that, so...
Right, exactly. Bounced back and forth. So it was kind of like the classic... Not necessarily classic, but you know, World Superbike is your launching point to get to MotoGP, and Bayless didn't have the greatest of experiences in MotoGP. So,
except when he was a wildcard rider,
exactly, and that was a weird one. That one, you know, the statistic analysis and all that—you got to throw that one completely out. But yeah, I just you got and Chaus, Fabrizio, Tomata, Regis Laconi did a season in MotoGP, didn't he? Yeah, and Robbie Rolfo. I mean, it's just this huge list.
Well, I think what we see is that there's these riders get much more visibility when they go to MotoGP, and then they could score better rides when they when they are looking at World Superbike.
Right. Yeah. That's a very good theory.
They've got you know they get sponsors, so they're worth more. And they can show off some skills too. So going especially you know. I mean, it's not like there's a dearth of like, hey, we need riders or anything like that. You know, there's riders. There's plenty of riders in many different series: British superbikes, Japanese superbikes, AMA. Where those guys, I'm sure that a lot of them would love to step up to World Superbike. But I think that there is an entertainment aspect to it, where like the the guys who run the show, they want superstars, you know?
Right.
And sure. And they want the sponsor money, so.
Right. So these are writers that already have a big fan base. They're already known worldwide. It's not going to just be, you know, this is the British Superbike star, so all the guys from England know who he is, but, you know, other people may not. Yeah, you're right. That's an excellent theory. And I don't think it's turning World Superbike in a bad way into the, you know, the place where MotoGP guys go to retire. You know what I'm saying? Because sometimes you see these lesser series of various forms of motorsport, and, you know, they end up being the retirement homes for racers. And and the series reflect that, you know.
Well, you can definitely look at the median age, and I think that, especially this year, I mean, God, MotoGP field is so young this mm-hmm. year.
Yeah. Because all the old guys went to World Superbike.
Yeah, and all these 250 guys stepped up. So,
yeah.
You know, we've got a bunch of guys that are, you know, barely starting to shave over there.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas World Superbike, the age is quite a bit older. And it, if you're reading down the list of names, it's almost like there's hope for you and me, Jules. I mean, we could probably get it. But, no, it's super good stuff. Overall, boy, I'm reading down the list of riders, and the list is the depth of talent is really impressive overall. I mean, and we're seeing some guys that are farther down the finishing order, like Muggeridge and stuff. And it's like, you know, wow, you know, not sure why this guy's career is sort of heading the way it was, but you know, a lot of talent, and Lacone and Rolfo Shoei Oyama. Hopefully, he gets his act together, and. You know, there's a lot of good guys, and this is going to be a good year for World Superbikes.
Totally.
It really is. And, so it was really cool to have some racing start finally after three and a half months of of no major motorcycle racing going on that we could watch on Speed Vision or what have you. You didn't watch the race on Speed, did you? You saw it online somewhere or something?
I will not speak about that.
You will not speak? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I should not have thrown you under the bus. But for those of us who watched
I did watch the Speed. The race on Speed, because I wanted to see it in its full glory, whatever. And I get to see a lot of commercials during really critical moments.
I couldn't believe it. That's what I wanted to bring up. It's like, you know, did these guys, is it still, who was it, somebody... production, Chet somebody productions or whatever, that does the editing of this thing. Did they even watch the race when they were editing it? Because I mean, it was like two commercial breaks in a row. We have a nice close race, and you come back and the pass had already happened, and it's like, come on, guys, you know, you're coming back on the same lap, but you kind of missed something there. And especially when you have a whole hour to fill with a race that takes 30 odd minutes or whatever it was, time of race, 36 minutes. Yeah. So, you know, a little bit less of the pre-race chit chat and Umbrella Girls, and maybe a little bit less of the post-race podium stuff. And let's see the entire race. If you've got to shoehorn it into a 1 hour show with a bunch of commercials, which the commercials pay the bills, I can understand that, then at least have the decency, because this race is not live. You guys can show us every second of on-track time. And so I was a little torqued about that, and
I totally agree. I mean, it's, you know, but this is like the speed formula. They do this so much; it's ridiculous. I mean, they will show the championship race on a freaking Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the
championship 2 weeks later.
2 weeks later, right? And then still, like, I mean, they've had 2 weeks to edit the damn thing, and they will still. You know,
screw it up.
They'll still stick a commercial, you know, and then come back and like, and now so and so is in front, and you're like, what?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it really is. It's so annoying. And and then I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked at the Speed Forum. I haven't participated there in a long time. But it used to always be there was the guys actually from Speed Channel would come on and defend their sort of, you know, things, and saying, you know, motorcycle racing just doesn't get the ratings, and that's why we play it at Tuesday at 2 a.m. And it's like, you know, I think you're putting the cart before the horse here, maybe. And maybe if you guys did a little bit better of a job, it might get some decent ratings. And I don't know, maybe if the American viewing population weren't a bunch of senseless chimps, we wouldn't have to watch Pinks and Superbikes and whatever last restaurant standing or whatever ballroom dancing crap all day long and get to see.
Wow.
And there's my annual TV rant. So, but I want Eurosport. Please bring us Eurosport here in America if you're listening. So whatever, it was a super good way to start the season. I'm really looking forward to Phillip Island, which we've got coming up here right away.
This weekend.
The show is on Friday, and World Superbike at Phillip Island will be on the Sunday immediately following. So that's cool. And then the weekend after that, we have MotoGP. So we got a lot of races coming on here in our right away, and that's good stuff.
And also wanted to mention that as we speak, it is 7 p.m. over in Qatar, where they're going out for the final test. Not all the teams are there, but I believe that we've got a good number of riders are going to be testing under the conditions, the same conditions as the race. So I'm looking forward to reading about that and seeing photos and whatever else.
Right, how it works out. And yeah, actually, there could be some truly spectacular photos with the artificial lighting and all of that.
Yeah, yeah, some cool shadows and stuff. I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
Something a little different because I mean, you know, I always like seeing the photos that we get. You do, there's one thing about MotoGP.com, there, you know, you get a lot of pictures to see and all that. It's just getting to them. But, but you know, the daytime shots at all the different tracks, they tend to blur together, you know. Oh, there's another shot of the rider leaned way, way over in the corner, you know, that kind of a thing. So,
there are some places where they're very special, like Phillip Island or like the long straight at Mugello and stuff like that. But yeah, you're right. I mean,
and the corkscrew,
exactly. They can run together. And I'm looking forward to it. I like photography, so I'm always looking at like the interesting photos, not just necessarily ones that show like the most interesting moment in the race, but like just for the aesthetic.
Right, the sort of the texture of the photo itself. What is the guy trying to do here? Yeah. And I mean, not to sound all artsy and stuff like that, because that's, you know, not me. But I know it's exactly what you mean, and I can appreciate this. Photography is like wine or art or anything else for me, where it's like I know what I like, and I don't know how to explain this, but it's like, well, that's a good picture.
Well, that's the way art should be. You shouldn't have to explain why you like something.
Yes, it just strikes you. And I agree that there's going to be some good ones coming from that. I think we've hit our time limit here, and the darn day job is going to intrude. Why don't we just call it a day? I think that it was a fun call, and it was fun to watch World Superbikes, and I'm looking forward to an exciting season of goodness.
We got a great month ahead. It's going to be very fun.
So why don't we say goodbye, and I will talk to you later real soon, Jules.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.
All right, that's pretty much going to do it for today's show. One thing I didn't go through in the call with Jules that I always go through is the results of the race. So why don't we cover that real, real super quick in our little outro that we got going on here. These are the results from the World Superbike Opener for the 2008 season that was held at Qatar on the 23rd of February, 2008. Race one, going down the list, Bayless Biaggi taking second place there on the podium. Nice for him. Corser, third place. So we had a Ducati, a second Ducati, and a Yamaha. Ruben Chaus in fourth, Neukirchner, Max Neukirchner in fifth, Carlos Checa sixth, Fonsi Nieto seventh, Yukio Kageyama in eighth, Michel Fabrizio in ninth, Jakob Schmertz in tenth, Robbie Rolfo in 11th, Keenan, I believe it's called Keenan, is his first name. Sofoglu, the Turkish rider that moved up from World Supersport, is set the world on fire in World Supersport. So he's going to be a force to be reckoned with there in Superbike once he sort of gets everything all accustomed and all that. So watch for him, Turkish rider there. Gregorio Lavia from Spain on the Ventaxia Honda was in 13th spot. Noriyuki Haga managed to get all the way up to 14th after his somewhat disastrous crash that he had earlier on in lap 4 or so. Regis Laconi in 15th spot. Lorenzo Lanzi in 16th. Carl Muggeridge in 17th. A. Badovini in 18th. V, which I believe is Vittorio Iannuzzo in 19th. Sebastian Gimbert in 20th. S. Nakatomi, 21st. Ryuichi Kiyonari, moving up from British Superbike, do believe, in 22nd. David Checa, Carlos's brother, 23rd. R. Holland in 24th spot. And Shohei Aoyama, 25th, final finisher. So, unfortunately, not classified in that race was Makoto Tomita, who entered pits. Doesn't say, you know, obviously doesn't say why or anything like that. But Makoto Tomita, riding the brand new Kawasaki ZX10R that they have so many high hopes for, failed to finish race one. Race two, well, let's run down those results again real quick. Give these guys their props. They worked really, really hard. Fonsi Nieto, which I was a little surprised about by his win, but it was cool to see him do it. He was in first spot. Ruben Chao, second. Max Biaggi, third, picking up his second podium, which it's going to give him some good points. He puts him second place in the championship overall after one weekend of two races. Fourth spot, Troy Bayliss, who is first in the championship. Michelle Fabrizio in fifth. Lorenz Lanzi in sixth. Troy Corser, seventh. Max Neukirchner, eighth. Jakob Smirt, ninth. Kenan Sofoglu, 10th. Carlos Checa, 11th. Makoto Tomita finishing 12th there. Noriyuki Haga, 13th. Gregory Lavia, 14th. Robbie Rolfo, 15th. Regis Ciccone, 16th. A. Badovini, got to look up that guy's name one of these days, 17th. Sebastian Gimbert, 18th. Ryuichi Kinaro, 19th. Carl Muggeridge, 20th. Wow, ouch. Come on, Carl. 21st, R. Holland. And 22nd, Shohei Aoyama. So again, we hope that Shohei kind of starts moving on up there. He's on the Alto Evolution Honda Superbike team, riding the Honda CBR 1000. I know he's capable of better results than dead last, so we got to figure out what's going on there. Kageyama did not finish that race, neither did David Checa. And let's see. Kageyama crashed. Yes, and I do remember that crash, actually, when they saw that. And then a few others in the pits and all that kind of stuff. Whatever. Fairly sort of quick slapdash kind of World Superbike race report, but I did enjoy the call with Jules, which was more of an analysis overall of what we saw there on the race. It was two good races. It really was. I'm looking forward to a good season of World Superbike. But one thing, and I think I said this on the call with Jules, and if not, I'll say it now. World Superbike is great stuff, and I really, really do enjoy it, but it's just not quite MotoGP. There's something lacking. It's not quite the same. So we got MotoGP starting in just a couple of weeks, and that is going to be good. I did take a look at those photos that we had up there on MotoGP.com of the testing that they did there in Qatar, the night testing. The photos from the first day are up as I record this, and it is striking. Just like Jules and I said in the in the segment, the photography is fantastic because of the artificial light, and it's just it's so different to see these bikes riding under a floodlit track. So they're riding under the floodlights and the way the shadows are hitting and it looks completely different from the daytime shots. You've got to check it out. MotoGP.com. Go look at the photos there. It's always really, really good stuff. And I think that about covers today's show. For those of you who are interested, and I've gotten a lot of email about this, got another letter from my son Alex, who's doing the Marine Corps boot camp thing. He's doing quite well down there. They finished up swim week this week. His platoon did not do very well in their senior drill instructor's inspection, and apparently there was a lot of throwing around of footlockers and dumping their stuff, not trash, but your trash, your military trash, which is all of your stuff, was thrown all over the place. And then apparently the drill instructor took everybody's padlock and stripped the pieces of tape off that had the recruits' names on the padlocks and then locked all the padlocks together. So that took them about 20-odd minutes or so to sort that out of whose padlock was whose and get it undone. So the torments are always mildly entertaining to hear about. He's doing well there. I don't, like I said, no letters of, oh my God, what a giant mistake I've made or anything like that. It actually sounds like he's kind of having a good time and trying to see the humorous side of it, of having his stuff thrown around in his padlock locked to, however many 60 other guys' padlocks or whatever number it is, as he is a slimy, grabastic piece of, amphibious crap and all of that in Marine Corps boot camp. So, and let's see, after that, don't forget to go to the helimedrideout.co.uk website. I will put a link up there on motogpod.com if you couldn't catch that one. So check us out, motogpod.com. Look for that link. Don't forget to go to David Emmett's website for Kropotkin Thinks. That's at motogpmatters.com. And oddly enough, you're going to find a link for that too on MotoGPOD. Big congratulations to Dennis Jones being the winner there. Congratulations. Have fun with their Ben Spies' tire warmers. And thanks again to David Podolsky for doing such a great content. And a great call. And that is going to do it. Thank you very much out there, folks, for downloading the show and for listening, for all your emails. I really, really do appreciate it. And we will talk to you next week.
MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.
Okay, boy, that was a
train wreck. Outro.
Yes, it's like just time to cut Bob off because he's completely babbling. He's, are you drunk? It's only 6 a.m. for crying out loud.